If your dial shifted or you pressed the wrong button and you are wondering where you are, you have landed in the wonderful land of WGXC. Whoa, I'm turning upside down. Wait, I'm not anymore.
Hello, my name is Holly Hedgepeth, and I'm with the Cancer Services Program of Columbia and Greene County, and you're listening to 90.7 FM WGXC ACRA.
The Catskill Town Board meets every first Tuesday of the month at 6:30 p.m. at the Catskill Town Hall and holds a committee meeting the third Wednesday of the month at 6:30 p.m. You can turn out in person at the Catskill Town Hall to speak at these meetings or tune in to a live web stream through the Catskill Town Board and WGXC. Go to wgxc.org/listen or click on the listen button at wgxc.org to tune in to any of the Catskill Town Board meetings, the first Tuesday of the month at 6:30 p.m. and the third Wednesday of the month at 6:30 p.m. at wgxc.org and townofcatskillny.gov.
WGXC underwriting support is provided in part by Sun Common, supporting vibrant communities across New York for over 15 years. Offering custom solar installations for homes, farms, and businesses. Information at suncommon.com.
WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of Catherine A. Lady of Hudson, New York. WGXC's sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about creative community radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXC as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties. You, too, can become a sustaining supporter by going to wgxc.org/donate and designating an amount of your choosing. Thank you for your support.
From the WGXC newsroom, this is the WGXC Daily News. Luke Parshnow reports at New York State of Politics that after a three-hour hearing April 17th, the New York State Senate's Judiciary Committee voted to send the nomination of Judge Rowan Wilson to be the next chief judge on the State Court of Appeals for a full Senate vote. Governor Kathy Hochul's first nominee, Judge Hector LaSalle, did not get approved by the committee. Wilson did, with all the Democrats voting in favor, four Republicans voting against, and one Republican voting to move the nomination to the floor without recommendation. If the full Senate votes in favor, Wilson would be the first black man to lead the court system in New York. Read more about this story at New York State of Politics. The Troy Record reports that Representative Paul Tonko announced 15 community development and improvement projects in his 20th congressional district that he submitted to the House Committee on Appropriations. This is what is sometimes called pork in Washington, D.C. Each congressional representative may request funding for up to 15 projects each fiscal year. Not all projects are guaranteed funding, but most get their dollars under the guidelines issued by the Appropriations Committee. Tonko asked for two of his 15 projects for the southern Albany town of Coeymans and the village of Ravenna. Coeymans, if successful, would get $1,882,500 for their sewer system, while Ravenna is asking for $3 million to improve their drinking water systems. Read the full story in the Troy Record. Raymond Pignone is reporting at Columbia Green Media that the village of Catskill will install 8 level 2 electric vehicle charging ports thanks to a $26,605 grant from the Climate Leadership and Community Protection Act, Governor Kathy Hochul's office announced April 14th. New York is giving more than $8.3 million to 70 municipalities, including five in the Capital Region, to install public electric vehicle charging stations. Currently, New York has 3,000 public EV charging stations. But Cornell University professor Bob Howarth says the state needs more, saying, and I quote, "I do think we have to have a much better charging infrastructure than we have now. There's a long way to go, but you know it's happening," end quote. New York's goal is to eliminate the sale of gas-powered vehicles by 2035. The story does not say where in Catskill the charging stations will be located. And you can read the full story at HudsonValley360.com. The Columbia paper reports that on April 23rd, the town of Stuyvesant turns 200 years old. On April 21st, 1823, New York State legislation went into effect carving Stuyvesant out of part of the town of Kinderhook. The town and villages of Stuyvesant Landing and Stuyvesant Falls were named after the former governor of New Netherlands, Peter Stuyvesant. In 200 years, the story says, Stuyvesant has had brick making and stove foundry, ice harvesting, a variety of mills, railroads, hotels, a bicycle emporium, and an island amusement park. The town is celebrating its birthday from 1 to 3 p.m. on April 22nd at the town hall with birthday cake, a video history, and many artifacts on display. There are other events celebrating Stuyvesant's bicentennial in July, September, and December. And you can read more about this story in the Columbia paper. And that wraps up the WGXC Daily News. You can visit our website at WGXC.org for local weather updates, public meetings, a community calendar, or COVID-19 updates. And while you're there, please click on the donate button to become a WGXC sustaining supporter or make a one-time donation. From the WGXC Newsroom, I'm Philip Grant. Have a good day and a pleasant tomorrow.
Hello and welcome to the better weather for Tuesday, April 18th. Local early morning temperatures range from 35 degrees in Tannersville to 47 in Red Hook. Regional average soil temperature is 52 degrees. Pollen levels will be high for the foreseeable future. That is in spite of the, yes, teeny tiny bits of snow I see flying around over parts of New York very early this morning. For us, even in the elevated places, we should just see some rain today. Those chances start around 12 noon. At 4 p.m., we hit our high temperature of 54 degrees. Rain remains light and comes to an end by midnight. Then we see a low of 34 degrees, happening just after sunup tomorrow. It would be a good idea to cover up any sensitive plants tonight before that happens. Tomorrow afternoon, it gets windy and we see a high of 55 degrees. Overnight, temperatures drop to 38 degrees. Thursday, still dry, we hit 70 degrees. And Friday, we hit 85, but then it gets wet again. If you think it's weird to see low 30s and high 80s in the same week during spring, then I would like to formally welcome you to the fine state of New York. Today's tide schedule is high tide at 2:14 a.m., low tide at 8:47 a.m., high again at 2:35 p.m., then low at 9:06 p.m. Today's river temperature will be 55 degrees and the tide strength will be high. Sunset today will be at 7:24 p.m. Sunrise tomorrow will be at 6:06 a.m. Looking way up, we see not a whole lot is happening at the moment, but there's lots of potential, especially with all those filaments dancing across the surface of the sun. We have a 10% chance of X-class flares today. Solar wind speed is currently 452.8 kilometers per second at 5 protons per milliliter. Radio propagation conditions are currently fair below 4 megahertz till dark, then fair across the board overnight. The 24-hour predicted KP index is 2. Quiet. The current sunspot number is 162. And this has been The Better Weather, brought to you by the Catskill Makers Syndicate.
Variety says this one won't miss. Awesome beyond description.
The most extraordinary output ever to emerge from the motion picture studio.
It costs $4 million and it has 4 million thrills. Production has eclipsed 10 million times.
Hello, with your host, Randall Martin, and today I have a very special guest from across the river in Greene County, and we're going to be talking to some of the proprietors of Made X Hudson, and they've got a fabulous handmade clothing boutique shop, and we have Eric DeFeo to tell us all about it. Eric, how are you, my friend?
I'm doing well. Thank you. Thanks for having me on.
Hey, my pleasure. So tell our audience about your very unique and the great operation you got going on over there.
Yeah, so we have a small batch factory where we have been producing clothes for fashion brands since 2021. And we've been working with dozens of brands around the country and now internationally. We're just shipped out a line to Paris. And we help small designers build their dream, because there aren't many easy ways to interact with factories. Most garment factories require several hundred unit minimums to produce with them. And we technically do not have a minimum to start. And so it's an easy way to get your brand started and test out the market. So like I said, we've been working with a lot of different brands around the Hudson Valley and the country. A lot of people have been reaching out to us because we're pretty much one of a handful of factories that are doing this.
So if I understand correctly, a designer can come to you with his designs and say, this is something that I want to produce, and you guys would sew it and create it for him. And you and unlike, you know, big, large companies that require, you know, a massive amount to produce, you would produce, you know, kind of just what they need.
Yeah, exactly. And most factories won't talk to you unless you have a pattern and a tech pack. And a lot of the clients that come to us don't really have those, or they may be hand-drawn. And so we help them do development, and we put the package together so that it can go into sampling and production. There's a lot of technical expertise that goes into producing clothes. And we've become unfamiliar with that as a country, as we've outsourced production to China over the last few decades.
Well, that's what I was thinking about, because it's now rare that clothes are produced here in the United States and manufactured and made here, never mind in our specific region.
Yeah, because it's expensive, you're competing with the cost of labor overseas. But now with COVID and the cost of everything around, it's starting to even out, because it may not be worth the shipping costs and the tariffs to bring things from China. So certain brands are starting to bring things to Mexico. We do have a partner in Mexico so that we can work with designers who have a lower retail price point that it wouldn't make sense to produce in New York. Having a factory in New York is great because it's the center of fashion, but it's also one of the most expensive states to live. As you grow, we can work with a partner in Mexico that we vetted and we believe is ethically run. It's actually woman-owned, and they do a lot of work with people coming that are formerly incarcerated as well. So we do all the development in New York. And if your retail price point is below a certain threshold, that means it would be very expensive to produce in New York and you would maybe lose money. We could also work with a partner in Mexico to produce there, which is also ethically run.
Excellent. Excellent. And have another one of your proprietors, Sergio's on the line. Serge, are you there?
Yes, sir. I'm here. How are you doing?
I am doing well. I've just been having one of those days, but I am doing well. Can you introduce yourself as well?
So my name is Sergio Celestino Guadarrama. I have been in the fashion industry for more than 20 years. Being in the fashion industry that long, I have seen the reality of what it costs to produce products in our industry, and it's a pretty terrible place to be. It's like the most beautiful from the outside, and it's the worst on the inside. And it's the second most polluting industry next to oil in the world. So I saw what was happening and wanted to kind of help the industry transition into a more sustainable future. And as I was trying to bring up these problems in the industry, there's so much money to be made off of slave labor, corruption, and all of these things, that most of what the industry is doing is very minimal, and a lot is not actually what they're saying they're doing. So I had a conversation with Eric a few years ago and just said, we need to do this outside of the industry because it's not going to change within the industry. And now a lot of designers, a lot of emerging designers are more aware of what it costs to the planet and to our fellow human beings to create. So we're creating a new model of how to manufacture ethically and sustainably for the future.
Very, very interesting, because it sounds like your business model is incorporating a social mission as well as an economic mission.
Yeah, we want to be responsible makers, responsible producers. And to make this type of impact, it takes an immense amount of energy and community and support. And we're transitioning and educating future creators that it's a possibility and it's a reality for us here in the United States to be able to make something that you touch, feel, and create within hopefully 100 miles of where you live.
So Madex Hudson is almost like a bridge for smaller designers to get their clothes into the marketplace.
It's a bridge. We provide a lot of different types of support systems for emerging designers and give them the opportunity to be able to interact with a factory. Typically, if you were to interact with a factory in another setting, you would have to be producing thousands of garments for them just to let you through the door. But with our facility, we try to make it as easy as possible with a 25-piece minimum so that people can not only be responsible in the amount that they produce, but not produce waste as we're manufacturing their products either.
It's not just that you guys are doing a smaller runs, but the craftsmanship and the attention to detail that goes into your products as opposed to some of the ones that are mass produced. Can you speak a little bit to that?
Sure. We unfortunately as a country sold off our talents in the 70s and 80s to other countries. And so we're kind of retraining and redeveloping the craftsmanship back into our country in a sustainable and ethical way. So we're really focusing on building community by teaching local people these crafts, these trades, and getting them up to speed. We would love New York State to support some of that, just because with all the burdens on our shoulders to kind of train a new generation of people wanting to manufacture. And it takes a lot of time and years to be able to master this craft. It's something that should be appreciated and supported.
Eric, we jumped right into what the company does, but we didn't really get a chance to talk about what brought you to this collaboration.
Yeah, so I run the Hudson Community Incubator, which is a mission-driven company to support small businesses in the Hudson Valley. And Sergio and I met through that, and we both aligned on the desire to do domestic manufacturing. I come from a startup background, and I also tried to do domestic manufacturing with hardware, which was very challenging. And so I thought I'd take on another challenge of doing that with the fashion industry together with Sergio. So we've been working together for the last 3 years on this project, and it's all integrated. This idea of supporting small brands, small businesses, that their core maybe is in technology. While every business today is technologically enabled, but most of the funding, whether that's private or public, it goes to more tech-driven companies that have like a technological underpinning, whereas we're supporting companies that are using very old technology, right? Sewing machines or their lifestyle businesses. Those are the companies that need a lot of support.
Now, judging by the amount of people and the enthusiasm at your event, a lot of people are very excited about this.
Oh, yeah. What we've seen through hosting our events, people are really hungry to connect and be together. America has really become an isolated place to live, where people are kept very busy on a hamster wheel and don't have much time for leisure. So when we create events where people can connect and take a break, people really enjoy it. So that's also what we're doing in our space downstairs. We spent the last 2 years just building the core of the business, getting it running. And so we're excited to finally create this space below our factory to engage the community, teach them about what we're doing. We're going to be hosting mending nights where you can come and repair your clothes. We're going to do clothing swaps where you can swap out your wardrobe and may not necessarily have to buy new clothes. But if you want to buy new, you can buy our house line and even get custom clothes made through our tailoring services. So people really do want to get back to making things with their hands. And that's why a lot of people do move to the Hudson Valley. So we're working to celebrate that. And we share the space with Co-Prosperity, which is an arts nonprofit. And then we also have Atelier Kuki, who makes bento boxes. And so we're really focusing on the artisans and the craft of making and trying to preserve it, because it's slowly drifting away from us as AI is becoming more popular. And, you know, this younger generation is getting really consumed and immersed in augmented reality. And we're seeing more people like yearn for in-person connection, working with their hands, because it's still so innate in our human consciousness to want to do that.
Welcome to 2023 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
In the coming weeks, the House will vote on a bill to lift the debt ceiling into the next year, save taxpayers trillions of dollars, make us less dependent upon China, curb our high inflation, all without touching Social Security and Medicare.
At the New York Stock Exchange, House Speaker Kevin McCarthy outlined Republicans' plan for passing a one-year debt ceiling increase. He and other House Republicans have called for more fiscal responsibility in federal spending. McCarthy's proposal would freeze spending at last year's level while enacting stricter requirements for social programs and a series of regulatory rollbacks. The proposal met the ire of House and Senate Democrats, who've consistently called for passing a clean debt ceiling increase. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer said McCarthy's approach could lead to economic tumult.
If Speaker McCarthy continues in this direction, we are headed to default. The main way we've avoided default in the past is to avoid and reject brinksmanship and hostage-taking, and instead work together in a bipartisan way.
With transgender rights under attack across the country, Washington state lawmakers are trying to protect them. Senate Bill 5599 aids homeless transgender youth and supports abortion care needs. Under current law, young people can only stay at a shelter for 3 days without permission, but this bill removes barriers to safe shelter. State Senator Marco Leas, the bill's sponsor, said Washington state is making itself a welcoming place for transgender people.
Especially at the national level, where the headlines just can be so hopeless. There are places in this country that care about our trans community and are doing what we can to be supportive and ensure that they can be as successful as possible.
Over 50 tribes and First Nations are demanding Canada end its support for the Enbridge Line 5 oil pipeline. In a petition to the UN's Human Rights Council, they're claiming this pipeline threatens the human rights of Indigenous communities and the environment. Canada invoked a 1977 pipeline treaty blocking any meaningful progress. Whitney Gravel, president of the Bay Mills Indian community, says this is about maintaining the sovereignty of Indigenous and First Nations people.
Ultimately, the reason we're involved is in order to protect the future of not only the state of Michigan and the water quality of the Great Lakes, but also to continue to protect the future of our Indigenous lifeways.
Arkansas Governor Sarah Huckabee Sanders is expected to sign a bill creating the Election Integrity Unit of the State Attorney General's Office. The goal of this new unit is to investigate potential voter fraud, though some feel this isn't a major problem. According to the Heritage Foundation, there have only been 3 proven cases of voter fraud in Arkansas, ending with criminal convictions in the past 2 decades. I'm Edwin J. Vieira for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to the American Democracy Minute, keeping your government by and for the people. We have 3 voter ID law updates for you today. If you live in Indiana, Ohio, or Nebraska, pay attention. New restrictions may make it more complicated for you to vote. First to Ohio, where a narrowing of what qualifies as identification to vote took effect April 7th. No longer can utility bills or a non-picture ID be used. Instead, only an Ohio driver's license, state-issued non-driver ID, U.S. passport, or military ID are acceptable. Out-of-state student college IDs no longer count, and to get an Ohio ID card, they must also surrender their home state's driver's license. Indiana has new ID hoops for voting by absentee. WFYI reports that the voter must enclose a photocopy of a state-issued ID with the return envelope, or include an Indiana driver's license or non-driver ID number, or the voter's last four Social Security digits. Nebraska legislators dialed back their proposed absentee voter ID legislation, which required a notary stamp. Another provision would have limited who could apply to vote by mail. The Nebraska Examiner's reporting showed that notaries are often not available in rural areas, so both proposals were scrapped, but legislators say they will implement some type of mail-in voter ID requirement before passage. We have links to more information about all three laws at AmericanDemocracyMinute.org. I'm Brian Beal.
Next, we have an interview from
WOOC.
To learn more about this program, the Sanctuary for Independent Media, visit us online at mediasanctuary.org.
This is Bria Barthel for Hudson Mohawk Magazine. And frequent listeners will know that every Monday evening and replayed on Tuesday mornings, I co-host this show with Blaze Bryant. I am talking again with Blaze, but for a different reason. This time, we are almost winding up our work as co-hosts. So I wanted to talk with Blaze about why he is stepping out. Blaze, I can't say welcome to Hudson Mohawk Magazine, but it's nice to talk with you again.
Always a pleasure, Bria. Thanks for having me.
So I checked my notes, and we first started co-hosting together in January 2022. That is something like 16 months off and on of co-hosting together. And I guess I drove you out of it, huh?
Well, no, you did not drive me out of it. And it's been a pleasure co-hosting with you. One of the things about radio and specifically doing Hudson Mohawk Magazine is co-hosting is very scientific. You either work with someone well or you don't. And thankfully, you and I have worked together quite well over the past year plus. We've been co-hosting, but I'm stepping away from co-hosting. I'm going to be contributing pieces to Hudson Mohawk Magazine because I feel as a correspondent with a disability, specifically, I was born totally blind. I feel it is more important and I feel it is better positions me to raise disability awareness issues as a contributor or as a correspondent, which also ties in perfectly with my work as a communications specialist with the New York Association on Independent Living. So just adding all that stuff up, it makes more sense.
So your blindness has been mentioned occasionally in passing on our show, and I suspect some listeners may have missed that or may wonder, how do you do a radio program when you can't even see and you've been blind since birth? So let's talk a little bit about how you manage to maneuver and function in a very visually oriented society.
Well, first, managing and functioning, you know, those are two entirely different things in the burial being the human race. Sometimes you can manage and functioning, people just make it sometimes next to impossible. But how do I do a radio show, specifically Hudson Mohawk Magazine? Well, I get emailed the Google Doc script, which I then convert into a Word document, and then I load onto a Braille machine, which is more or less like a Braille computer type of gadget, is the very simple way of explaining it. And that's how I read the headlines and do the script.
For listeners who aren't familiar with Braille, that's a way for visually impaired people to read using their fingertips over a series of dots. Can you explain that a little bit?
Well, yeah. So it's, you know, Braille was invented about 200 years ago. You know, different dot combinations represent different letters. That's kind of the short, sweet, simple explanation of how Braille works.
Now, when you say your Braille machine, I was envisioning a paper punching thing that would make the raised letters on paper, but it's much cooler technology where little pinpoints come up for the letters and they scroll across at the base of sort of a typewriter or computer or something.
Yeah, so it's on a readout on the bottom of the machine, and I know exactly what you're talking about. Yeah, those Braille embossers, they take up a good amount of space and they make a lot of noise, and yeah, everything's electronic. And there have been times, I think it's important to point out, I've not been able to co-host because, well, the technology, it's not perfect. The machine had to get fixed a couple of times, and I was working off of other machines that were a lot smaller, and it makes it far more difficult to read the script because it's so the readout on the bottom of my Braille machine is 40 characters across from left to right, which for doing broadcast stuff like this is ideal. At least to me, it's ideal. And I've been doing radio and stuff for at least 10 years. Whereas the machines I've borrowed, it's 14 characters across. Ooh. At times, not even a full sentence. And you're
at times not even a full word.
Yeah, yeah. Although if you're using 14 letter words in radio, I question why, to be honest. So it's just one of those things where it's a lot of clicking. And I'm also someone who feels the quality of the show is the most important thing. And if my technology or if there's something that significantly inhibits the quality of the show, then I feel it's best for me to just step back and have someone else step in.
Now, you mentioned sometimes stepping back, and yet you usually more often step up by being a disability advocate. So tell us a little bit about the range of disabilities and what is involved in doing disability advocacy.
Sure. Well, disability advocacy, here's the thing. 1 in 5 people identify as someone with a disability. That could be either a physical disability, for example, blindness or cerebral palsy, you're a wheelchair user because of spina bifida. I'm just using a few different examples just to make a point. And of course, there are far more disabilities than what we have time to get into, and I truthfully don't even know all of them. There are also hidden disabilities. You know, mental illness is very much a hidden disability, or I've also heard the term invisible disability. In terms of disability advocacy, it depends. You know, is it a housing issue relating to the accessibility of one's home? Is it ensuring people who use home care have the services and supports they need to get out of bed? Because if you can't get out of bed, then what quality of life do you have? And home care workers do not get the wages they deserve. Accessible housing is pretty few and far between. And the programs to make home modifications, you have to jump through a lot of hoops, and the eligibility criteria is very limited. Or specifically to my work as a communication specialist, ensuring the staff that work at independent living centers throughout the state get the long overdue cost of living adjustment they deserve for doing the same work as other human service agencies, but we don't get that money because we're in the state budget. So therefore, we don't get that human services cost of living increased because of that. So disability advocacy can be very nuanced and be very open-ended. It all depends on, like most things, the issue.
So you've done a great job of showing the range of types of disabilities and the range of issues. So I was delighted to hear that you are going to stay connected with Hudson Mohawk Magazine as producing segments about this. Can you give us some sneak preview of the kinds of segments you have in mind?
Yeah. Pretty simply put, I want to focus on agencies in this area, meaning the Capital Region, who serve people with all types of disabilities. And what I have drawn up are these 20-minute segments that we split into two. One The first part is, let's talk about the organization and what they do. And then the second part, focusing on issues they are advocating around. And that could be in support of a bill, opposition to a bill, because I feel like it's very important with us being so focused on social and environmental justice. And to me, environmental justice, that encompasses housing accessibility as well. It's more than just climate change. At least that's just my own view. So it's really important to, you know, not just say, okay, this is the agency and here's what they do. Why do they do the work that they do?
Sometimes people don't think about disabilities at all, or if they think about it, it's like it's not really their thing. One of the many things I've appreciated from working with you is my heightened awareness of who is or is not included in information, in who is or is not represented in our work. So I really respect the work that you have done, look forward to the work that you will be doing. But I got to tell you, come Monday nights, Hugh Johnson and Sina Bazila Hickey and I are going to be missing you. But look forward to your upcoming segments. Thanks a lot, Blaze.
Thank you, Bria.
On Hudson Mohawk Magazine, we've been reporting about the budget and its being overdue. I'm now joined by Assemblymember Sarahana Shrestha, who has been working very hard on many issues, which we will get into now. Welcome to Hudson Mohawk Magazine.
Thank you so much. It's such a pleasure to be here. I can dive right into it. This is my first term. I've been an elected official for only 3.5 months now, and it's been, sort of a confirmation of all of the things that I had a sense was broken in Albany as an outsider climate organizer trying to, you know, push state legislation. But yes, we are a few weeks behind on the budget. You know, you may have heard in the news that the primary reason is the governor really wants to do further tweaks to the bail reform law that we passed in 2019, and not much moved until there was some resolution on that. So that's really been the main reason for the delay.
A lot of your work focuses on the intersectionality of issues, understanding that wealth inequity and climate justice are interconnected with housing, education, healthcare, systemic issues. How has this approach shaped your work as a New York State legislator?
Yeah, and you know, it's worth pointing out, I was born and raised in Nepal, which is in the global south, and it's, you know, where all the sort of the mountains and the glaciers are, right? So it's an area where you can really feel the effects of global capitalism, right? That's one way to put it. So I've always had an intersectional lens. You know, climate for me is, you know, not just about environmental conservation. It's not about, you know, nature as a separate thing. It's about justice as the nature of which we are a part of, right? Like, we are part of nature, and everything we do, everything our economy does, changes nature, shapes nature, and that's how we've arrived at this climate crisis. And, you know, the exploitation of nature being a key component of our economy really started during, like, the sort of very early stage of capitalism, when people were like, oh, we can quantify things and therefore we can exploit them more easily. And that happened with slaves, right? Like, people were used as free resources found in nature instead of seeing them as human beings. So that's really at the core of how I see everything. And so I know that I've arrived in Albany at a moment of multiple crises, which is, you know, inevitable. You know, it's our economy that has always put profits first is sort of imploding. And we are seeing the effects of it in housing. We are seeing the effects of it in criminal justice, you know, in how we talk about public safety. We are seeing that in, wages. You know, we, on the one hand, we have very rich people who are protected. We have this obsession with this myth that we need to convince rich people to stay in New York, which is, you know, in reality, rich people can stay wherever they choose to. They're not doing math and calculation because they have too much money. So they're not going to decide where they live based on how much they're going to save. You know, the whole the freedom that they have is they can go wherever they want. Whereas when we talk about minimum wage, you know, we're talking about $15 being high, and it's not high compared to $1 million, you know. So there's all these symptoms of really the same thing, which is an economy that at its core relies on exploitation. We when we talk about inflation, sometimes it feels like what I'm hearing is poor people need to stay poor so that we don't have inflation, which is a very twisted way of talking about our economy, because, you know, we should be striving towards an economy that survives and that and actually strengthens as we have more equity and equality.
So you, in that, in your intersectional answer, you were talking about how many of the focuses that we were going to talk about intersect. So you mentioned tax the rich and the fear that rich people will be leaving New York State and therefore leaving us with this income. Can you address that a little bit more about, like, why is tax the rich not working when we have such a huge amount of really rich people? And one thing I want to dispel when we talk about tax the rich is it would only affect a really small margin of people who have such a mass of wealth.
Yeah. So, you know, in terms of like why there is reluctance and why people are worried, you know, a few people are worried about millionaires leaving and so on, is we really have a culture of fear-based politics. And a lot of it comes from people being fixated on what they stand to lose, which is like very narrow in its scope. You know, for politicians, it's re-election, right? It's donations. That's what they are constantly thinking about and what they're going to lose. But if we really want to make change, we have to widen our horizon by thinking about what we need to win, what we need to gain, right? What we can gain. So a really funny example is, you know, in Ulster County, the county legislature is proposing to raise the bed tax for, like, you know, short-term rentals by 2%. And there is opposition from the tourism industry, which is saying that it would discourage tourists from visiting Ulster County, which is a perfect example of fear-based thinking, because there is no way that people are going to calculate where to go because they're going to pay $2 more on a $100 room. You know, it's just not happening in the real world. If you zoom out, it's similarly for tax the rich. That when people left New York, it was during the pandemic, right? And actually, it illustrates the fact that during the pandemic, rich people could afford to go wherever they wanted. They could sort of quote unquote flee to wherever they chose, you know? And so we cannot ignore the fact that this entire pandemic, which was quite disruptive, quite novel to our generation, happened. That just sort of created all these unplanned migrations that people decided to do. So there is no data really to support that, you know, rich people flee when the tax increases. And there is a lot of data to show that in New York, which, by the way, is the most unequal state in the country because of the gap between the very rich and the very poor, we have plenty of data that shows that rich people can afford to pay a lot more. And right now, what's in play in the budget is the Senate and the Assembly are saying for people who make $5 million or more to raise just a little bit of a tax, and that would still generate enough revenues to save a lot of things that we are trying to save. And the governor is pushing back even on that. And frankly, to me, the pushback is because she actually is quite disconnected from the world outside her world. You know, the fact that these policies are popular across party lines, you know, and age and so on.
Yeah, we are quickly running out of time. We only have about 2 minutes and we only really got to the tax the rich. But on the flip side is raising the minimum wage. So these, like, the state really supporting the rich and not the people who are really running a lot of the things that we need. So in this 2 minutes left, what other issues do you want to briefly talk about?
And I can make it very quick. On the flip side, if you're not asking the rich people to increase their share, you're asking the working class people to increase their share. So there's no, you know, there's no other choice. So we're talking about housing costs. There's a lot of price gouging going on. We want to protect tenants by passing good cause. It's a very reasonable bill. It's not even radical. It still allows landlords to evict when there's a good cause, such as if they need the space back for personal use, or if the tenants are not paying their rent, and so on. So we really want to make sure we pass this. And then just across the board, making sure we are not passing costs to people who are not rich, like tuition hikes for SUNY. We don't want that. We don't want to cut services that people need, you know, legal services, for example. So there's a line we're trying to hold on making sure those costs are not being passed to people who are least able to afford it.
Assemblymember Sarahana Shrestha, thank you so much for joining us on Hudson Mohawk Magazine. Before we let you go, what are your thoughts on where the budget is going right now? When will it be finalized and what will be in it?
We're thinking that it will be around April 24th. That's just a guess. As for what will be in it, the correct answer everybody has is we have no idea. We really have no idea. We're in the dark here. We have guesses, but those are not based on, you know, firsthand information.
It's been a pleasure to have you on Hudson Mohawk Magazine.
Thank you so much.
We have one more segment with the terrific trio of you, me, and Hugh Johnson.
Yes. And, hello? Well, Bria, you did the intro. How are you, Hugh?
I'm great. I'm great. How about yourself?
Doing fine, thanks. As we, you and I, we do these weather musings live for the last time, and I will say this to you. If you ever need to tape a segment, let me know and we'll make it happen.
Okay, great. Sounds like a plan. I'm going to miss working with you, Blaze. It's been great.
You, right back at you. It's been a pleasure working with you. I got to say, you know, as someone who can't see the weather, I never really thought I'd get too excited about it. And you've made it kind of interesting for me. I got to be honest with you.
Well, thank you.
Yeah. Well, so a little digression. Let's get straight into why we've had such hot and cold weather, quite literally, here over the past few days.
Well, we've been in what we call a blocking pattern. We've talked about this before. The polar jet has weakened, lifted north, but we're left with these cold and warm bubbles of air. We got under a pretty strong ridge. For a while there, we were under a trough back in late March, early April, and then suddenly we flipped the switch and temperatures cranked up to your 90. I actually hit 90 twice at my house, but I don't count. I'm not official, but 89 at the airport, so we didn't quite make 90. But what we did do, Blaze, is the first 16 days of April have been the warmest ever on record in Albany. To the, you know, the first 16 days, including that, those 4 days of 80 or above, and we had two record highs and two record minimums, just an incredible stretch of fine weather. It got real dry, but today we got rain. We got 0.6 inches of rain, so we got what the doctor ordered for the gardens, and we cooled off, and now we're going to be back to a little bit below average the next couple of days, yeah.
So you mentioned that we got rain, but what's happening in Florida? Was that some kind of preseason tropical system that gave them all the rain?
Not really, Brady. That was actually not tropical. That was clearly – that was a cold core low, an upper air low, which was forecast. The rain was forecast, but not the amount. Basically, a mesoscale concentration of very heavy rain right over Fort Lauderdale. Fort Lauderdale – and what's funny is a lot of these times these don't happen near airports. We've talked about that. But this one happened literally right on top of their airport. So they got the worst of it with almost, are you ready for this? Almost 26 inches of rain fell, I think, in a 24 to 36 hour period. That's 1/3 of their annual rainfall and more rain by almost 5 inches than we got the entire year of 1964. I kid you not. So they got.
Wait,
that,
say that and again. How many inches did they get?
Nearly 26 inches of rain. An epic amount.
Holy
God. They blew away their 24-hour record by 9 inches, which was in 1979. So, again, it was very concentrated. There was rain across much of Florida, but it was in the 1 to 3 inch range or so. So it was they could handle that, but nobody can handle 2 feet of rain. And the city was just a mess. It's a miracle. I don't think there were any casualties. Don't hold me to that, but I did not see any reports of casualties, which is amazing. But the streets were underwater. I have a friend that lives down there, and he said his house barely missed it, but a lot of houses underwater. It's going to be billions of dollars of damage, I'm sure. So just, and it was not tropical. It was not tropical. It was a slow-moving system with a mesoscale emphasis right centered in Brownton County on Fort Lauderdale. So, yeah, a terrible situation. And I think they're going to get more rain today. So, you know, they don't need any more rain, obviously.
Well, I mean, that's just incredible. Hugh Johnson with me, Blaze Bryant, and Bria Barthel here on Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I can't help but wonder, is Florida in for a projected brutal hurricane season this year then?
Not necessarily, Blaze, because one thing that has changed is that remember we talked about La Nina, the cooling of the Pacific. That's over now. We're neutral, and we're going to trend towards an El Nino. Now, when you get El Nino, you get other issues that are problems, but one thing it does is it increases the shear over the Atlantic Basin, which makes it harder for hurricanes to form. So if anything, we should have less hurricanes this year. But, and this is a very big but, if they do form, they can be very powerful. Remember Hurricane Andrew in 1992? That came during the El Nino season. There was only four named storms, but no one remembers the rest of the storms that season, but Andrew was a legacy. So Camille also hit during an El Nino year. So if they can form, they can be very powerful. So I would say watch out for less hurricanes maybe this year, but maybe they'll be more powerful. Hopefully not. So and answer your question, it's a mixed bag. The Atlantic's still very warm, so anything that gets going could get potent, you know, have lots of juice to form, but you got to overcome that shear that you get with a presumed El Nino by the fall.
So you've mentioned the crazy, crazy highs and lows that we or the warmth that we've had. What impact will that have on trees and plants and agricultural crops back up here in New York?
Everything is springing out early. Green up is happening now a week to 2 weeks early, which is in keeping with everything south of us. It was interesting that things were popping out south of us. We had nothing, and then we had this warm spell, and now we're about 2 weeks ahead of where we should be. It could make us a little more vulnerable to some if we were to get some colder nights, and we could. I don't see any big freezes, but, you know, things are coming out a little earlier, so there could be some damage or some blossoms and stuff. I don't think it's going to be anything huge because I think we're late enough in the season that it won't be anything too problematic, but bugs will be coming out a little early now that we got the rain. So there could be some impact, absolutely, because, again, we're running a little ahead of normal, and that makes us a little more vulnerable to those chilly nights that could still lie ahead.
Yeah, I mean, and then the fires in Schoharie, I mean, my goodness, what a terrible deal that was.
Yeah, there and a couple of other places, too, that had some of the brush fires. This is the most active fire weather season we've had in years because, again, it was we had 2 weeks of very dry weather before the leaf up. It's still not fully leafed up, but everything, we had the antecedent conditions, very dry, warm weather then and low humidity. Mm-hmm. So, and wind, at least some of the days. So, yeah, we had some real problems with fire weather. I haven't seen that since, I would say, like 2015 or even before that. So it's been a while. Yep.
Sure. Forecast time, Hugh, 45 seconds.
Forecast time. Blocky pattern going on. Tomorrow it's back to 50s, cooler weather, maybe a spot shower, breezy but sunny on Wednesday, 50s. Then we start warming up again, and by Friday, 80 degrees. And it looks like warm weather is in the 70s on Saturday, probably dry. So the next chance of real rain after today is not till next Sunday, or late Saturday night into Sunday. And then after that, it looks like it might actually cool off a little more again. So up and down weather continues as kind of expected for mid to late April.
All right. Well, Hugh Johnson, flat out of time. Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure working with you, and we will talk soon, and you'll be back next week with Bria and Sina.
Excellent. You too, guys. Pleasure working with all of you. I'll miss you, Blaze.
Likewise.
And listeners, as you just heard, Hugh will continue his weekly reflections with us, but he and I will, and Sina and all of us will miss Blaise in those conversations, but we'll be delighted to hear his segments on disability advocacy and disability issues.
That interview was from
WOOC.
To learn more about this program, the Sanctuary for Independent Media, visit us online at mediasanctuary.org.
From the WGXC newsroom, this is the WGXC News Update. Andrea Mickle reports for Porcupine Soup that unknown chemical fumes at the Halion plant in Oak Hill in Greene County sent someone to the hospital on April 14th. Durham Ambulance, Oak Hill Durham Volunteer Fire Company, Greene County EMS, Cairo Ambulance, Ashland Ambulance, and East Durham Volunteer Fire Company turned up at the plant that makes oral care products. One person was taken by ambulance to an area hospital for minor exposure, and 12 others were evaluated on scene but did not require hospitalization. The story did not include any other information about the chemical leak. And you can read more about the story in Porcupine Soup. Nick Reisman reports for New York State of Politics that there is a good news and bad news for New York taxpayers, as State Comptroller Tom DiNapoli's office reported $2.9 billion more tax revenue than expected for the fiscal year that ended April 1st, but $9.5 billion less than the previous year. DiNapoli said, and I quote, "The financial position of the state remains on a solid footing for now. While tax collections have exceeded projections, they were considerably lower than last year. Although easing inflation continues to present challenges to economic growth, state policymakers should ensure that the enacted budget for state fiscal year 2023-24 commits additional resources to the state's reserve funds to improve long-term financial stability," end quote. Sales tax and business tax collected by New York increased by almost $1 billion each. And you can read more about this story at New York State of Politics. Doug LaRocque is reporting for Capital Region Independent Media that Norm Rasmussen is returning to the New Lebanon Town Board after the March resignation of Town Board member Britt Buckingroth. Town Supervisor Trista Hodling said Buckenroth's schedule was too busy to stay on the board. Rasmussen, a former town board member, fills out her term through December 31st. There will be three council seats on the November ballot, with two for four-year terms and one for the two-year term remaining on Buckenroth's term. Read more about this story in the Columbia paper. Liz Montgomery reports in Porcupine Soup that Haley Dixon, Becky Pine, Russ Nadler, and some other Athens residents are trying to stop a cell tower going up in their town because the thin pole obstructs their viewshed. ARX Wireless, Verizon Wireless, wants to put a 155-foot cell tower on Farm to Market Road to improve local cell reception. The company's application says, and I quote, "Approval of the project will enable Verizon Wireless to provide an adequate and safe level of wireless telephone service to the identified area of the town of Athens and surrounding environs," end quote. But the trio's group says that, and I quote, "This area is one with stunning views, and the proposed placement would be in the center of the mountain views from both east and west," end quote. The proposal for the cell tower is before the Athens Planning Board, which next meets at 7 p.m. Thursday, April 27th at the E.J. Arthur Elementary School in Athens. Read more about this story in Porcupine Soup. And that wraps up the WGXC News Update. You can visit our website at WGXC.org for local weather updates, public meetings, a community calendar, or COVID-19 updates. And while you're there, please click on the donate button to become a WGXC sustaining supporter or make a one-time donation. From the WGXC Newsroom, I'm Philip Grant. Have a good day and a pleasant tomorrow. And now, here is your WGXC weather update. Your forecast for the next 2 days. Well, on Tuesday, there will be a slight chance of showers before 8 a.m. Then a chance of showers afternoon. It will be mostly cloudy with a temperature high near 53 degrees. Tuesday night, a slight chance of showers before 2 a.m. It will be mostly cloudy with a temperature low of around 36 degrees. And on Wednesday, mostly sunny with a high near 54 degrees. And Wednesday night, partly cloudy with a temperature low of around 35 degrees. And that is your weather update from WGXC. 90.7 FM radio for open ears in Greene and Columbia counties.